Anyway, I'm going to say good morning, everybody, and welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're here to talk about, well, what is it? What is really happening here? And why should I care? good questions, but we're looking at the, we've been looking at the review lessons, and we got into the review lesson of lesson 158, which is, to me, one of the pivotal lessons of the course, that talks about the script and about the uselessness of trying to do anything to change what is in the script and the usefulness of taking the hand of the Holy Spirit and allowing yourself to be shown the truth about things. And, you get a lot of pushback, and a lot of Course in Miracles students will say, yeah, but I need to do this, or I should have done this, or we should be doing this, or this is how things should be. The way that it appears to me from this concept of the script is written, and you may have a different idea about this, and I'd like to hear it, so I can blow it away. but to me, the script was written long ago. It was over and done, and all we're doing is walking through and observing or looking at what our mind, the contents of our mind, the contents of this mind of this illusion. All we're doing is looking at it and having a choice of whether to believe it and be in fear or to not believe it and know that we're safe. And if I think somehow or the other, I can make a plan that can change the script, that can alter what has happened long ago before the thought of Lynn and the thought of Bruce, you know, talking here, well, it was already there. If I think that I can alter that, then that is one of the most terrifying thoughts in the world. This is why people are so afraid, is because they believe somehow that they can alter what is, and if they don't do it right, then it's going to cause tragedy. And even if they do it right, they don't know what the outcome is going to be. And, you know, to me, the reality is that I can't do anything about it. I'm just here walking through it. And if that's the case, then I really only have one choice, and that is either to listen to the Holy Spirit and be shown what things are for, or listen to the ego and think somehow or the other that I can subvert the plan and make something better, something I like more. But I always fail. You're always going to fail when you make your own plan, and because my plan will never happen because the script is written. So I'm going to be disappointed that my plan didn't happen. But that's still in the script. That's some crazy stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. As you were sharing that, Lynn, I was thinking, you know, one of the really fundamental ideas in A Course in Miracles is that what we truly are, and our, you know, our language fails us because are is a plural verb, and it presupposes the idea of duality. But, you know, in the total collective, you know, one identity sense, you know, what our true identity is, as one being, is a transcendent reality that really has nothing to do with the form, nothing to do with the physical expression that happens in space and in time, which lesson 158 goes into the time dimension in great detail. You know, a trick, a sleight of hand, a vast illusion. You know,
yeah, it's rich.
In which figures seem to come and go if by magic, you know. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing is if we can remember, to let ourselves off the hook and let each other off the hook by gradually shifting our identity from the separate interest to the shared interest, I think that really is a pivotal practice that reminds us that, you know, we really have not committed any crime in truth against this oneness that we thought we destroyed, and it appears to be running rampant in a world of you know, crazy scripts that we seem to have no you know, complicity in. And yet, like you're saying, if we could change this script, the game would be over. Well, I mean, Holy Spirit's game would be over, which isn't even a game. But if we could change the script, then we would be forever stuck, because we'd be forever trying to manipulate a dream. And, you know, and it appears that we're doing that. It appears that we're trying to change a dream to our liking. But no matter how we rearrange the pieces of a dream, it's still a dream. And I think, you know, what seems to happen, at least this is my, you know, very incomplete understanding as Bruce, you know, but, you know, the awareness that is behind that suggests that, you know, I think what's sort of happening is here's this is my theory again, is it seems like, you know, the script is really multidimensional and holographic in ways that we can't even imagine. And so as we forgive, and this is kind of the result of kind of letting the ideas in the course, as well as Gary Renard's work, you know, and Martin and Persis' suggestions that, you know, we shift the script, or we go maybe jump to a different place, hyper jump to a different place with quantum forgiveness in the dream script that seems to have different situations for us to forgive. And until we recognize that they're all the same, until we generalize and realize that, you know, if everything really is the same, then in truth, and everyone is the same, then we just need to convince ourselves by, you know, maybe it's just a matter of enough examples, or, you know, we're undoing holographically the part that we see as seeming individuals played in, you know, unraveling oneness. We have to re-ravel it. I don't know if that's a word. We have to kind of, you know, roll the spool of yarn back together and unspin the yarn that the ego told. How's that for mixing metaphors? And until, you know, there's no longer any interest in trying to manipulate the dream. And then I think that happens, you know, a parallel to shifting our identity from one of separate interest to one of shared interest. And by seeing that our peace of mind is completely intertwined with everyone else's peace of mind, we're not at the mercy of whether or not others appear to be choosing the thought system that is responsible for peace of mind, but we're responsible for how we respond or react to what seems to be happening in the dream, and whether or not we, you know, rise above the battleground of that illusion of duality and see the truth, the essence of the spirit that we all are in each of those interactions and each of those situations. And that's a challenging one. The Course never claims to be easy. It always claims to be simple, because truth being one is infinitely simple. How's that for another oxymoron? You know, the infinite oneness of what we are is nothing could be simpler, because it's all inclusive and there's no other to fight against it. And that's, you know, right at the beginning, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies a piece of God. It's like, wow, what a profound statement of pure non-duality. And it takes us years and years to really let that sink in, and to allow the true identity that we all share to begin to be prominent in our minds by practicing forgiveness and practicing mindfully noticing that following ego's insane strategy just does not work for bringing us peace, and in fact seems to reinforce this insane dream, insane script. And really, it's not that we're changing the script or changing the dream. We're changing our identification with it. We're changing the way we relate to it. We're changing what we think about it. And that's the true reality, because even physics, you know, had to sheepishly admit that some of the basic premises upon which physics appeared to be based in Newtonian times were brought into question with the introduction of, you know, mind as a primary aspect of reality, with the Copenhagen interpretation and quantum entanglement and, you know, so many other aspects of modern physics that suggest, you know, like physicist John Wheeler said, there's no out there.
Right.
Go ahead.
I said, yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So if that's true, then, you know, then our whole foundation, our whole premise for believing in a dream world with a dream script, or maybe multidimensional dream scripts, or however we want to look at it, even that is just a dualistic attempt to understand a phenomenal projection of duality, and try to make sense of something that ultimately has no sense. But the only thing that really seems to make sense is to forgive ourselves for the decision in our mind that appeared to have led to the appearance of a dream in which we seem to be, you know, the martyr or the victim, or, you know, entangled in a surreal, nightmarish, ultimately, existence that is finite. And of course, Miracles just on every page and every sentence and every letter, proclaims quietly but patiently, it ain't so. Nothing happened to destroy that oneness that we all are and share. And that feeling, that awareness, that understanding that leads us inexorably back to that place in the mind is something we all have. And we can pile all kinds of, agendas and beliefs and mental mini storage lockers full of junk in front of that awareness, but it doesn't mean the awareness is gone. It just means that we've chosen to block it out. But that's only for us only. I mean, we can hold our thumb up to in front of the sun and say the sun is gone, but no, the sun's still there. It's just, you know, we're blocking it because of a well placed obstacle that appears to make it seem not there. Somewhat.
Yeah, I like that. And that's, we call that in the emergency services, as I used to teach and train people to be emergency responders, and we call that rule of thumb.
And oh, okay.
If it's a bad enough accident that you can hold out your thumb and you can still see it, you're too close. So, anyway, that's for toxic chemical spills and such like that, or things that are really bad. You know, get away, stay away, and follow the rule of thumb until you have the proper equipment. Anyway,
yeah, makes sense.
That's too the rule of thumb. You know,
if
you can see it, then you know obviously it's something that needs to be looked at, and the whole idea of forgiveness, which is, you know, I know Art Nampursa and Gary emphasize over and over and over and over, because Jesus emphasizes it over and over and over and over. The rule of forgiveness, or the role of forgiveness, is not looking at what we think has gone wrong and then saying, oh, it's okay. Forgiveness is looking on what we think has gone wrong and asking the Holy Spirit to show us a different way of seeing.
Exactly.
And so forgiveness doesn't happen through my mind, my thinking, and my judgment and my ideas. And, you know, I can't convince myself that forgiveness is good. All I can do is ask the Holy Spirit to show me a different way, or show me what is really happening. Because otherwise, I'm going to believe it. I'll believe that it's true, and I'll believe that it is not only true, but that it has a capability of effect, having an effect on me, and that there's nothing I can do about it to change that effect, and therefore I'm going to suffer because of the effect, and I'm a victim because of that. You know, these are all things that come about when I look at something that calls for forgiveness through my own ego mind. When I look at it with the Holy Spirit, then what I see is everything is fine and perfect and nothing has gone wrong. I can see that very clearly because I understand that my own opinion is the ego's opinion of what is and should be. My own plans are the ego's plans for what is and should be. The truth in reality is my own anything has no meaning. The images that I make up, my imaginary images, imagine, that if I imagine that I see suffering, if I imagine that I see sickness, if I imagine that I see a body, these are all images that my mind has made. And the fear, if there's no control, if there's no plan, if there's no script, the fear that I have is that my powerful mind can make even more gruesome images. My powerful mind can make things even, and if I stop to think about it, ooh, the crazy stuff I can come up with. And it terrifies me to think about that. But, you know, these are not things that I'm imagining and making up now. These are all part of the tiny man idea. These are all part of that thing that, you know, I made up long ago. All, anything I can imagine has already been imagined. And all I'm doing is looking at it, looking at the contents of the dream and the illusion. And so to recognize that I can forgive, which means not that I can say, oh, this is bad, but it's okay because I'm with God now. So, you know, you know, you can go ahead and do your evil ways. Instead of looking at it and seeing guilt and then thinking that something has to happen, I can look at it and see there's no guilt here. Nothing has gone wrong. This is all an imaginary story. It's like waking up from my dream at night, where in my dream at night somebody, you know, beat me up, and I wake up in the morning and I'm like, I'm going to go get that guy because he beat me up. It didn't happen. It was a dream. That's this life. It's not happening. It's a dream. And recognizing you're dreaming, you will wake up. That's to know this cannot be true. This cannot be real. Holy Spirit, show me the truth of this. When you see the truth, you will laugh. You can't help but laugh. And so, you know, you can laugh at all these evil things you think are happening because it's your imagination. You made them up. Don't feel guilty because there's no reason. Excuse me. As I cough guiltily into your ear. So I think the other key to that, and we'll go on to reading our book here in a minute. The other key to that is to look at what appears to be outside of me, my brother, and see that he is also guiltless. And in fact, I can't even know my own guiltlessness until I give him his.
Yeah. In fact, the other day I stumbled, I think it was in a study group or something. I recognized that the two words put together, are sort of an oxymoron. And those two words are individual innocence. In a sense, you know, in the sense that you can have innocence for one and not another. You know, in a dualistic, dream world, we can imagine that, but it never sticks because it always shifts back and forth between the unconscious guilt in the mind and its projections. Whether we think momentarily we're the innocent party and someone else is guilty, or we switch it around, you know, no matter how it plays out, there's always this assumption that something is wrong and some kind of blame and trying feverishly and frantically to, you know, foist that on someone else, you know, not in my mind's backyard, please. But the whole thing is so much, you know, it's so much rooted in just the whole premise of duality. And that I was noticing, and, you know, of course, you know, if we just watch our thoughts and our language, we'll see how permeated our thinking is with the whole premise of duality, which is there's an I. And if we just notice how many times in a sentence or in a paragraph, and not that we usually record our conversations in paragraphs, unless you're a novelist, I suppose, just court reporter or something, but just notice all the times we use I, me, my, you, your, his, hers, theirs. They're all, you know, possessive, isolating, fragmenting concepts that belie the fundamental, so deeply entrenched idea of the ego's basic premise is that separation from perfect oneness is possible, and that it actually happened. We actually think that we pulled it off, and that's the impetus for this unconscious but unfounded guilt. And it's only until we look at that premise with the Holy Spirit, by bringing each specific that happens in our mind, each part of the dream we want to fix, each part of the script that seems to be amiss, and it really is just our forgiveness classroom. If we can just take each specific instance, bring it back into the mind that we share with what A Course in Miracles calls Holy Spirit, or our inner kindness teacher, that awareness we took with us into the dream that is completely forgiving, that completely recognizes the fallacy of guilt, and sees that in truth, in the eternal, infinite reality of being that we all share, nothing happened. The I and the me and the my and the you and your and his and her and he and she and all those, you know, we, they, concepts and constructs dissolve in the perfect forgiveness that A Course in Miracles espouses and promotes and shares with us in so many different ways, by just looking at the insanity of the war that we make between self and others, the war that we make between one aspect of our dream world and another, and just see how ludicrous and how ultimately hilariously, outrageously funny it is. But the point isn't to become outraged. The point is just to say, wow, how could I have believed this for so long, and to forgive ourselves, and in the same instant, same breath, let everyone else, because there is no else or everyone other than in the oneness and truth that we all share, off the hook. Just, you know, let everyone and everything off the hook, because the differences that appear to us aren't real. But we need those differences. We need those apparent differences as triggers for the discomfort in our mind. And that's why I think why Jesus and his wonderful curriculum here, you know, in almost every section of the text and elsewhere, uses the tremendous power of contrast by not mincing any words and showing the, you know, abject fear, the over the top insanity, and the you know, perverse craziness of the ego's thought system. Not that it's sinful, wicked, or evil, but it's just profoundly silly and absurd. That why would we want to do that to ourselves? And we do that, and we reinforce that every time we think that, oh, I need, not want, but, you know, need as in a compulsion. So it's in essence, you know, all of our egos are OCD all the time. Whether we try to suppress that or not is another matter. But, the compulsive, obsessive need to try to fix the dream and to make things in the world be as they appeared not to be. what a great diversion, huh? Anyway.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. And if you really want to know about that, look at chapter 23 of A Course in Miracles called The War Against Yourself.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one.
Mm-hmm. And Jesus will point out every silly thought that you have, every silly notion that you have about, you know, what exactly you're doing here. And, you know, you do have to laugh when you start looking at it. You know, when I start looking at, you know, I made it up, and and none of it is to be believed. But how I hurt myself over it, and how I make myself afraid, and how I worry about it, and how I want to do something different or make it different. You know, Jesus says, make this year different by making it all the same. Mm-hmm. You know, what does he mean that? You know, that's in chapter 15. Make this year different by making it all the same. You know, he's saying, you know, when you start looking and you see that it is all the same, it's the same process, the same problem that the you know, the worm has when the bird is eating it. to the worm, it's a problem. To the bird, it's a solution. When you start seeing how we set these things up so that they're the cause and effect are so, seem so evident, and we seem so affected and like it really truly can hurt us, and the reality of it is, these are just what would happen if we could be separate from God. This is what would happen if we could be separate from God and acknowledge we cannot be separate from God. I can't separate myself from my source, and God has ordained that everything be perfect. So my brother is perfect. Look at the chapter 30, the justification for forgiveness. And you know, Jesus spells it out step by step by step by step why it is that you can't judge and be truthful or be honest. You can't judge and really know your brother as the Holy Son of God or know yourself as the Holy Son of God. And once you start seeing, you know, the clear logic that Jesus puts into this course, you know, the only way that you can deny it is through denial by saying, yeah, but that doesn't happen to me and that hasn't happened to me and I don't see that and what about this and what about that? All of those things, that's the sickness, the denial against the truth, is saying it doesn't apply to me.
Yeah.
Salvation doesn't apply to me. Salvation doesn't apply to this situation. Salvation doesn't apply to, you know, how this thing works. And that is a sickness. Salvation applies to everything. And it is the solution for everything. And, you know, once you begin to see that, oh, yeah, this is the same thing. It's, you know, I keep talking about that show Westworld. It's getting now to the point where the host, the robot, you know, whatever, AI, are saying, well, look at this. I've done this thing over and over and over and over. How many times have I been killed? How many times have I killed? How many times has this happened? And, you know, they're seeing in their lives, oh, gosh, you know, this is just a game. You know, that's where we're getting to. You know, I'm getting to that, and you're probably getting to that, too. It's like, oh, my God, you know, I keep doing the same thing over and over and thinking something different is going to happen. It's not, you know, and we can walk into any room in that dream museum and relive a whole scenario, a whole lifetime, and still not have the solution because we haven't come to the point to recognize, oh, this is a museum. This is a theater. This is not my real life.
It's a massive theme park for the ego's shenanigans to play out, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you should mention, you know, the sickness because I was just reading some of Ken Wapnick's commentary this morning in his Journey Home book about the middle of the book, which is right in the first part of the second section of the book where he starts talking about the fear of God and I couldn't help but be struck after rereading the portion that he quoted from Lesson 136 that mentions the double shield of oblivion, how much that related to a fellow I got to meet years ago when a group that my wife and I started called New Frontiers of the Gold Country hosted a number of speakers over about a 9-year period, monthly, roughly. And one of them was David Icke. And he has some, you know, interesting stuff to share about, you know, the secret societies and covert conspiratorial stuff that, there's all kinds of interesting things out there, and it can be a diversion. But one of the things that he shared, and some of it, I think there's a whole lot to it, but at the same time, you know, the point isn't that, you know, we should go after all that stuff and immerse ourselves in it, which, you know, is neither here nor there. If you're drawn to it, you know, fine. If not, fine. But to me, what was more important that he brought up in the way he presented these conspiratorial, you know, agendas was I thought it was a great metaphor for the ego's strategy. And he laid it out as a, you know, essentially a problem, a solution, you know, package that really never undid the problem because it was always addressed at the wrong level. And so, you know, for, you know, the way that, you know, a lot of these political maneuverings take place is they create the problem and then they propose a solution that, you know, basically makes them look good, like, oh, here he fixed this problem or she fixed this problem, you know, kind of diverting the fact that they actually, you know, started it. And
like, let's take away their babies and then, oh, let's give their babies
well,
back.
Well, there's a current... a current events story that might apply here, yes, but you know, trying to keep it back to the general principle of, you know, the ego shenanigans, and we all do this. We've made up this massive problem, which we call the world, and we reinforce it at every turn by making it real and making the things that seem to happen in the world real to seemingly separate selves that seem real, that have labels like you and I and he and she and they and we and us and them and,
exactly.
And all those identifications, which wow, they're so convincing. You know, it's incredibly you know, high production value, special effects, theatrical, over the top, high resolution presentation, theme park, hologram of the mind, but it's all a projection. It's just something that's made up in a deluded mind to convince us that there's a problem, and then it proposes a solution that always reinforces the problem by keeping us away from the actual source of the problem, which is the decision in the mind. And so, you know, David Icke's material, if you've ever looked at any of that, actually plays right into that and gives, you know, some great examples in, you know, the geopolitical arena and you know, many other places. And certainly all you have to do is, you know, flip on the TV or your radio or your computer and you know, look about current events. But the trick is to notice it, you know, under your own roof and in your own mind. You know, don't have to go outside your neighborhood or your own.
Well, that's very true too.
Two feet in front of you. Just notice. I keep reminding myself, if I can just remember to reel it back inside, it's not about the other person. It's always about my own choice for the decision making faculty in my mind that shows a thought system of insanity, and I see it playing out over and over and over again, because that's my desire. That's my secret wish.
Yes.
To be a martyr or a victim. And that's why, you know, some of the hardest hitting passages in A Course in Miracles are in the most challenging ones, you know, have phrases like, you know, behold me, brother, at your hand I die, you know, because we basically are desperate to find someone else to pin the blame on. But if nothing happened in truth, then there's nothing to blame. So it's, you know, a classic magician's redirection technique of, you know, look over here where the real problem is in the mind. It's not never in the body or in the world. It's always in the mind. And we conveniently forget that moment to moment because we're motivated to keep the separate identity that we think is going to bring us something we like. You know, and we just have to, over time, notice that it never does. And when ego shouts loudly to the contrary, just notice the fuss that it puts up and how the volume and the pace and the panicky, frenetic quality of its shoutings in our mind to convince us that we are these dream figures, it really picks up the pace as we get close to, you know, the place in our mind where it says, gee, this is all made up. Why would I want to be upset about that? You know, 'cause we're never upset for the reason we think. And that's because it's all happening in a dream world that is in our mind and has no bearing in truth. should we read a little Gary stuff?
Sure. Just really quickly, though, I wanted to add into or comment. I used to think that like David Icke Dave Wilcox. There's a bunch of people that have all these ideas, these conspiracies, and these aliens, and all these things that are going on in their world. Their world. That's what their reality is. And I used to think, well, that's a bunch of bullshit. Because how could that be that there's aliens and blah blah blah? Because none of this really exists. And then I realized when I understood. As much as I could, anyway, the whole concept of the script is written. I came to understand that if we imagine that, which we must have because we're imagining it now, if we imagined it, that was equally made into a world for us to travel through as well. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. The world he's traveling through has all these conspiracies and Illuminati and whatever. I'm not sure if he's an alien person or not, but the world they're traveling through has all these things, and they are actually absolutely real as me sitting here in this chair, which says it's all a story. It's an imagination, and it is in their imagination. So. What we behold, what I perceive is what I project. If I'm projecting it, I'm perceiving it. So that doesn't mean that it doesn't actually exist. Well, I guess it does mean it doesn't actually exist. But in this world reality that we're experiencing, there are aliens. There is Bashar. There is Abraham, being spoken to what's her name being spoken to by all these alien minds. That is actually happening in her reality and to some extent in my reality because I'm witnessing it. I'm seeing it and perceiving it. So I'm actually projecting that as well. But the only thing that I'm actually capable of perceiving in this world are the things that my mind projects, that I'm projecting. So, someone says alien, and I think of what's his name from The Family Guy, or My Favorite Martian, someone says alien, and I have a projection of a thought in my mind of what that is. Or it could be a person from another country coming into our country, alien. Whatever it is I perceive as alien, that is my own perception. That may not be the perception you have or David Wilcock or anybody. They have their own perception of it as well. And they may not think that in any way at all. That may not be their, they may see these as benign, benevolent beings. They may see these as... But they're all in their mind. Nothing exists except what is in my mind. Nothing I perceive exists except for what is in my mind. And so this is why so much about how we behold our brother, how we behold the world, how we behold the Christ. It all has to do with what is in my mind, my own thinking. Because in reality, yes, there's no Lynn, there's no aliens, there's no world. The reality of it is that none of this exists. The imagined reality that we live is that everything we can imagine exists. Because everything we can imagine is what we put into the story. Does that make sense? I know it's really conceptual, but when I look at it, and the moments that I can be really aware that that's the case, then I just have to laugh at how absurd my thinking is to come up with all this shit. I just have to laugh that I could be so brazenly opposite to love, brazenly opposite to truth, to God, and think that it's okay to be thinking these thoughts, to be condemning or vilifying or being afraid or any of these things. It's silliness. And Ken Wapnick said that a lot. Just silly. That's just silly. You know, and he laughed a lot about the silliness of the dream. And yet we look at it and say, oh, it's so serious and I'm so afraid. Well, I'm only afraid because I think that it has some capability of hurting me or changing me or doing something. And nothing can change it. Nothing can change the tiny mad idea, the script. Nothing can change that. The only thing that can change is my mind about it. And that's the miracle. And when I change my mind about it, then I have this gentler, softer thought. And when I behold my brother, I see him as just the same as me, someone acting out a story in a dream that is not his story or his dream. It is that is not who he is. He's not the dreamer, although he appears to be. What he is what I am, when we are the same thing. The same mind thinking out all these bazillions of crazy stories and deciding whether we believe them or not. And the Holy Spirit's here to tell me how to forgive that, how to look at that, see the actual truth of what is, and then deny the denial of the truth.
It's true. Yeah, I think that, you know, what you just shared, Len, is you know, the perfect reason for, you know, being compassionate and kind to ourselves and others when we catch ourselves, you know, or deceiving others, engaging in fearful thinking, you know, rather than, you know, it's all well and good to know that anything that's in a dream is not real, but we also are called upon to share in a way that minimizes the fear, and really it's ultimately in our own minds, but in a way that, you know, helps everyone in our lives to move as quickly as possible away from the scene of the mental crime of fear, to use your emergency response metaphor, you know, to get to have it where it's, you know, it's under our thumb, so to speak, but not ours, is the Holy Spirit. So a few moments ago you said something that kind of reminded me that it's really the innocence that is the true nature of what we all are and share. And the ego wants to you know, use its dark light to make everyone Illuminati, but the Holy Spirit says we're all Illuminis. So,
oh my gosh!
How's that?
All right.
So enough Illuminati. As a pivot, yeah. to get into Gary's book.
Yes, exactly. Okay. All right. So. I'll start. Okay. And we are in the lifetimes when Jesus and Buddha knew each other, a history of mighty companions by Gary Renard. And I'm on page 127. Is that where you are?
I actually have us on 128. Did I skip a page? Or?
Oh, you know what? Because I'm on the Kindle. So,
okay.
But I'm thinking, let's see, because why don't you start, and I'll see where you're at.
Okay. I have this right at the top of 128 where Gary says, is it all right if I ask a couple of general questions as I get workshops about the future
that's
and stuff?
That's at the bottom of 127 on my page. So.
Okay. Persa, sure. If we don't want to answer, we'll just stare at you. Gary, okay. You said once the Dow Jones Industrial Average would pass the 100,000 mark by the middle of the century, 2050. You told me back in the 90s. As of today, it's around 21,000, and there's only 33 years to go. Do you still stand by that prediction? Arden, yes, it's going to be 2022 before the worldwide economic expansion we talked about will start to pick up steam, but we still stand by that statement. Gary, cool. A doctor told me that I have high blood pressure. He wants to put me on medication, which I imagine would be for the rest of my life. Is there an alternative treatment I can use, or should I just use my mind? Arden, who do I look like? Edgar Casey? I think they're dishing out some of Gary's smart-assness back to after years of karmic input, it seems like.
Or years of living with Gary.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And as Gary.
They're probably just doing to hold his attention because he speaks fluent smart-ass, but in essence, we all do because we're all arrogant to believe that we're here, right? Okay, let's start that over. Arden, who do I look like, Edgar Casey? But we have given you health advice before, with the understanding that it's all right to use magic as long as you know that all sickness, as well as all healing, is really caused by the mind. But until you attain the same level as Jay, it's okay to have a little help. So try taking 300 milligrams of potassium a day. Usually you can find that at a health food store, usually in 99 milligram tablets or capsules, so take 3 of those a day. Also take 500 to 600 milligrams of magnesium a day. Make sure to do both and don't go over these amounts. This will work without any drugs or side effects. Then Arden continues, when it comes to your dream world, as both Benjamin Franklin and Emerson said, health is the first wealth. In your future, people will turn more to supplements and natural treatments and away from drugs. It's not that some drugs won't remain and be genuinely helpful to some people. It's just that most of them exist in order to fatten big pharma. Also, it will become general knowledge that the correct level of oxygenation of cells prevents and cures diseases, which will be a game changer. That fact has already been emphasized by no less than 3 Nobel Prize winners. But the medical industry does its best to suppress cures and has been very successful at it. The money is in treatments, not cures. Note, when I went to the doctor, my blood pressure was 156 over 102. After 2 months of following Arden's instructions, it was 128 over 86. I also read that new guidelines by experts were saying high blood pressure is no longer considered to be 140 over 90, but 150 over 90, unless you have diabetes or kidney disease, in which case it's still over 140 and 90. By either measurement, my blood pressure would have been considered to be high by the doctor. Incidentally, my guidance is that anyone should always consult with a doctor when it comes to a medical issue, but under the guidance of Arden and Persa, who I consider to be the Holy Spirit, I took it upon myself to do the potassium and magnesium instead of the medication. So again, this is not what Lynn and I are saying is not medical advice, and standard disclaimer here. Anything you hear,
stop taking your medicine.
We should be well advised to do what you feel inspired to do, and don't bypass common sense within the dream, and follow the sanity in your own mind. That's the true sanity that's there, and do what you feel inspired to do in the world, and oftentimes that will include just being practical. And do you want to continue from there?
Sure. Okay. We're getting into my stuff now. Okay, Gary, how about global warming? Will the situation get any better? Persa, by now I'm sure you realize that nothing gets done until it's absolutely necessary. Because of those who are acting like they're in denial of science, but are really lying for monetary gain, there will be significant damage to the Earth in this century, especially the second half, and we're seeing that right now. Many cities will be flooded and hundreds of millions of people displaced. Global catastrophe will eventually be averted, but not without much damage and suffering. And I'm just going to digress here for a moment because you know I am an environmental engineer and that's something I pay a lot of attention to. I'm not worried or afraid because, you know, I think, well, this is, you know, it happens. We evolve and I've heard many people say that, you know, this is getting the Earth ready for our alien overlords because they need to have things be a certain higher temperature than, what it is right now. So we're actually preparing the Earth for the invasion, and that our politicians and business guys are aware of it and they're in cahoots. So, but don't take that. I don't believe that. That's just That's just what I've heard. And, you know, when you look at it that way, it does make sense. Well, yeah, if that's the environment they need, then of course they're going to try to make it so that this environment matches it, like we would do if we went to some other planet and destroyed all their ecosystem. But anyway, so...
Destroying an ecosystem?
An ecosystem, yes. these things happen not because we're trying to cause trouble. I'm sure that these people who are doing this are just saying, well, you know, I can make a few million more dollars if this worked, and what's it going to hurt? You know, who's it going to hurt? And they don't realize that, you know, right now there are people in island nations who are losing real estate, and some may even, you know, some islands may even be completely underwater in a very short time because of, not as some senator or congressman said, because the rocks are falling off the cliffs of Dover, and that's what's causing the, or some cliffs, that's what's causing the water levels to rise in the ocean. That was actually something that a politician in America said just recently. but you know, the Earth is going through all sorts of stuff, and you know, you can say a lot of it is because of drilling and fracking and global warming and all these different things. But really, you know, there is no purpose to it. It really is just a part of this dream, this imagination. So, you know, is there a reason to be concerned? Well, no. Ultimately, you know the truth. You know, nothing can harm us. But temporarily, it may be very, very uncomfortable for some people. And so, you know, my job is not to make the world more uncomfortable for others. My job is to be truly helpful and to act with love. So to me, an act of love is, you know, not driving a high carbon emissions vehicle. You know, to me, an act of love is being a vegetarian and not eating, you know, beef and, you know, animals that put a lot of methane gas into the air and cause more global warming, and you know, all the, you know, there's so many things, and I'm not want to go on a big tirade about this, although apparently I am.
I think one of the things too that this is a real easy thing to do, and I know there's been a lot of talk about this over the years, that, you know, people call themselves humanitarians, but if you eat humans, that promotes a lot of fear. I suggest that anyone who considers themselves a humanitarian and eats humans, you know, that you just try, you know, more vegetarian, you know, lean toward a more vegetarian diet. So
then that might be helpful. Might be helpful to become a humanitarian, because if you ever read the book Stranger in a Strange Land, Michael Valentine Smith, who came from Mars eat their dead. People in Mars eat their dead because that's a waste not to. And, you know, they have limited resources on Mars. So, you know, when he looks at the corpse of a person who is on display, you know, somebody who died, and, you know, people are looking at their body, all he thinks is wasted food. You know,
well, Matt Damon did some of that too on The Martian, I recall, but in a different form. But
yeah. So, but the idea, you know, that we pick one thing as, you know, edible and another thing that's not, or you see this chart that has, you know, cows and horses and sheep and goats and dogs and cats, and it says, you know, where do you draw the line between what you will eat and what you will not eat? Is all really
the cannibal spectrum? Because we're all eating something else. I mean, every breath we take, we consume, you know, millions, probably billions of bacteria, microorganisms, and exactly. You know, process those into our bodies and rip their cells apart and without even thinking about it, you know. So,
well, and actually,
even if you're
our
breatharian.
The cells of our bodies are living creatures,
right,
who are fighting and living and dying and doing all sorts of things in their little world too.
And it makes those epic battles in Lord of the Rings look, you know, minuscule, huh?
Exactly. It does. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess, you know, really kind of what we're talking about here is that, there's really no difference between all of these things. We're the ones who are drawing the lines and making the differences and saying, this is good and that's not. This is right and that's not. When none of us really knows, you know, global warming may be the greatest thing that ever happened. It may be opening up things that we never knew. There may be health issues that will be solved. There may be
trade routes for super tankers across the North Pole, maybe?
Yes, trade routes for the super tankers across the North Pole. There could be all sorts of things happening here. We just don't know. And, you know, we may end up with in Water World, you know, Kevin Costner, Water World. That may happen. Is that a good thing? You know, it's nothing.
It is.
These are all stories. Okay.
Everything we've been reading so far from Gary's book is perfect fodder for remembering to keep level confusion, as a principle to look out for in the mind when we're dealing with physical advice about physical things. You know, if the Course says there is no world, the central thought the Course attempts to teach, it doesn't mean we don't do things in the world, we don't react and interact with things happening in the world. It's just that we shift our identity from a separate self to a shared self, and over time that helps us be more truly more compassionate because we're not invested in the outcomes. And we're actually then free to make choices that result in kinder outcomes that are more beneficial to everyone, even within the content and the context of the dream. So, right?
Well, yeah, and also as you were saying that, it came to me that the whole thing or the linchpin of all of this is my decision as to either to accept or reject what's happening, because it's in the script, as we were just saying, that if that happens, that's what's in the script. So my choice is either to accept it and get on with, you know, things and allow the Holy Spirit to guide me as to how to see things, or reject it and fight it. And that may be in the script too, that I'm going to fight global warming till the death, or, you know, I'm going to go down to, keep the whalers from killing whales, or I'm going to sit here in my room and have, you know, I get a thing from the the power company every month saying your household is using 80% more energy than any other household in your neighborhood. And, I'm like, yeah, that's very true, because my household is, people are up 24/7. There are probably 12 computers running full time. People are probably watching television, have lights on. This is a busy household. And so it's not like my neighbors, they're sleeping at night, you know, they don't have 12 computers running. So anyway, I could feel guilty about that and say, oh my gosh, I need to save energy. But that's what's happening. That's what's happening. You know, apparently, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, or it wouldn't be happening. I don't know what I'm saying other than, yeah, you know, I'm responsible for all this pollution that's going on. Thank you very much. But, but it doesn't really matter because it's all a part of the story. This is the story of Lynn. This is the story of Bruce. This is the story of the Earth and global warming. And, you know, that's, you know, it makes a riveting scenario. And it's riveting enough to keep me from focusing on the truth. So it's doing its job.
It's ego's novel idea, but it's just a novel in the mind.
It's just a novel. That's right. That's right. I love it when I talk to you. You always come up with those. So, continuing on with reading, Persa has just said global catastrophe will eventually be averted, but not without much damage and suffering. There will also be natural disasters unrelated to climate change that will be bigger than anything the world has ever seen in this cycle of history, such as volcanoes going off and I mean, I have a volcano alert on my phone and have had it for a couple of years, and I'm telling you what, there's volcanoes going off every day. Anyway, there will be some occurrences that will be terrifying. I'm sorry, but we can't give details. Just be ready to forgive no matter what. It doesn't matter what it is. Earthquakes, tsunamis, bigger and more frequent storms, or people, or crazy people winning elections. Do your job. Gary, how about water? We mentioned it earlier. What's the future of the worldwide water situation? Gary, quit being so concerned about the future. Oh, no. Persa. That was not in the book. I just made that up. Persa. Not good. As we have said, people always wait until it's almost too late before they really do anything. The ego loves crisis and the resulting fear. For example, the technology already exists to turn salt water into clean drinking water, but it won't be done until it's absolutely necessary or until someone figures out how to make a lot of money from it. By the way, to be fair to your adopted state, California is blamed for taking a lot of water from other states, but don't forget what you give back. You grow more fruits and vegetables than any other place on earth. I don't say that because it's real, only to point out that the ego needs to project its unconscious guilt onto somebody else, and a lot of Americans seem to do that with California. Yep, California is where we project our guilt. Well, now Washington, D.C., but but California, too. Gary, in Hollywood, I used to think of it as a place with a lot of spoiled brats hanging around the swimming pool. Now he lives there, and taking drugs. Then when I moved out here and spent a couple of days on set, I saw how hard they work, like 16-hour days. I learned to judge less and have more respect for people. Speaking of Hollywood, I went to see the latest Star Wars movie. Of course, it was technically impressive and very entertaining, but it dawned on me that they were doing the same thing as all the earlier films in the series, having conflict and setting up that one battle after another, supposedly trying to balance the force. And that's funny. The first time I went to see Star Wars, I went with my girlfriend, and she's, when we came out, she goes, I don't know what's the big deal about that. It's just like a Western movie, you know? And I was like, yeah, I guess you're right. It is just like a Western, same storyline. Okay. So, well, the yin and the yang, except for the force and the empire and all, but anyway, well, the yin and the yang are always going in and out of balance. That's duality. It's futile to expect to keep it in balance. That's why it curves. And they have this huge audience that goes to see these movies. So I was thinking, instead of just having the same old conflicts, which we know is a result of the conflict in the mind, why not add a new subplot? It doesn't have to be overdone, but how about if they introduced a couple of new characters? They could be light beings. They wouldn't have to change everything about the movie series all at once, but these light beings could simply suggest to some of the main characters, you know there is another way. Then they could slowly bring in true forgiveness because the universe is just a hologram, which would be right up their alley, and they could still really make a good, really make an entertaining movie. It's just that instead of having nothing to say, the movie could actually be doing something interesting. Persa, could you repeat that? Arden, it's a good idea, but they have no financial incentive to mess with a good thing. Maybe you should stick to our TV project, which I don't know what's going on with that. Okay. Note, I have been trying to get my books made into a TV series, along with my writing partner and co-producer for this series, Alicia Skye. I had been working part-time on the project for 6 years. We were making progress, but it remained to be seen if we would be successful or whether it would turn out to be just another forgiveness opportunity, a JAFO. Either way, I was enjoying all that I was learning during the process. And I'm going to stop reading. I think you had something to say, maybe?
You know, I was just kind of enjoying what you were sharing. Not that I'm ever at a loss for words, but how about if I just pick up with the reading and we'll go on?
Okay, yeah, before you do that here, I just wanted to come back and say something here. I don't want to keep hyping this television show because it just seems absurd. And people watch it and say, I don't get what you're seeing in this, Lynn. Everybody says that. I don't get what you're seeing in this. But that show, Westworld, It does have. I mean, they are introducing some concepts that are just mind-boggling in understanding or knowing the truth and reality of what sentience and consciousness and life, you know, what is life? What is love? You know, they're asking some questions that are just way beyond anything I've ever seen or heard in a television show. Some movies hit on it, and of course, you know, it's Christopher Nolan or Jonathan Nolan, one of the Nolan brothers that makes that show.
Oh, okay.
So you know they have their that deep philosophical belief and understanding about life and the universe. That is why I see, like, from that movie Inception, and mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of them. But that show Westworld is introducing some stuff that if you're into this kind of teaching, it'll blow you away. I mean, it's amazing to me. When every time I watch it, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I sit here in stunned silence sometimes for an hour after I've watched the show and have to go back and watch it again to really see what has happened. So anyway, it can be.
I think any virtual reality, presentation, if it explores the premises of the idea of virtual reality, we can't help but share things that help us open our minds to the idea that this is a virtual reality presentation, movie, projection, dream, whatever we want to call it. And just that, entertaining that idea over and over again will lead us to question the veracity of this, not just the sensory data, because optical illusions and all that kind of stuff are good examples of how you can't really trust things at face value, but really trust the premise upon which they were made. And that's, to me, the more important thing, is that the place in the mind that felt the necessity to make up a holographic dream, surreal, projected universe in the first place. And like you say, it really does call into question what is life, what is love, what is reality, what is true compassion, what is our real identity, and could it possibly be limited to anything specific? No. How's that for a quick snappy answer?
That's a quick snappy answer. It absolutely. I guess you can see it everywhere. Be vigilant for only for God and His kingdom. Eventually you begin to see it everywhere and everything.
Exactly. Yeah, and I try to practice that whenever I'm watching, anything on TV, whether it's a Netflix movie or anything on my computer. Try to generalize. If we can just say everything here is a reflection of one of two thought systems. And I can see it either way, depending on what frame of mind I'm choosing it at moment to moment to moment. And the only way out of the matrix, the inception, the dream, the levels, the quagmire of my own personal Truman Show, whatever, pick the West World of terrorized existence. Pick your virtual reality favorites or your metaphors, but they're all basically just getting back to that same choice point in the mind between inclusion and exclusion, between kindness and a corrupt government in our mind that makes wrong portions of reality. So, should I go on?
Yeah, why don't you go on?
Okay. Gary says, all right, one question I've gotten a few times in the workshops is, when this is all undone and we're all home in God, what's to stop the separation from happening again? I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it from you. Martin, the Course is teaching that the separation from God never happened. So you've never left God and you're having this dream, but the only way you can really know the truth of God is to experience it, to experience God directly. In the experience of that reality, which can happen for anybody, very briefly at first, there are no questions. There is only the answer. There's no doubt or fear. Questions come from doubt, but there is no doubt in spirit. So the only answer that will really satisfy you when it comes to that kind of a question is the experience of your perfect oneness with God. After you have that experience and realize there are no questions in that experience, only the answer, you'll appear to come back here. And then after a while, you'll realize that you have questions. And if you're really observant, you'll realize that you're dreaming the questions. Why? Because those questions literally do not exist in heaven. They exist only in a state of separation, which is only a dream and thus never occurred. Only a virtual reality TV series or movie or whatever, right?
Right.
This is another example of where the awareness of dreaming comes in. The more you realize that you're dreaming, the less you'll question God. And it's the experience of God that makes you realize that what you're experiencing here is not true. That knowledge, or gnosis, is personal. As the Course says, truth can only be experienced. It cannot be described, and it cannot be explained. I can make you aware of the conditions of truth, but the experience is of God. Together we can meet its conditions, but truth will dawn upon you of itself. Now, if the separation never happened, it can't happen again. Still, the Course does offer an answer to that question within a metaphoric structure for those who may need encouragement. The Holy Spirit is the Christ mind, which is aware of the knowledge that lies beyond perception. He came into being with the separation as a protection, inspiring the atonement principle at the same time. Before that, there was no need for healing, for no one was comfortless. The voice of the Holy Spirit is the call to atonement, or the restoration of the integrity of the mind. When the atonement is complete and the whole sonship is healed, there will be no call to return. But what God creates is eternal. The Holy Spirit will remain with the sons of God to bless their creations and keep them in the light of joy.
Yeah, that's really important stuff. Yeah, I just want to stop for a minute because that is really important stuff. Mm-hmm. Because the question, you know, what's going to keep us from doing this again? And because, you know, it's kind of tricky because it says what, you know, God created is eternal. The Holy Spirit is the really the Christ mind that has not been affected by the dream or the imaginary world or whatever. But it's still, as a figure in our mind, is kind of the stopgap that's going to keep us from, it's going to be, you know, if we think again, let's try this, because we will have forgotten every bit of this. That's the thing. One of the things that people are opposed to waking up about is because they don't want to forget the world, even though Jesus tells us, forget this world. But they don't want to forget the world. They don't want to forget their family. They don't want to forget these things. When this is over, you know, it's over, and there's no more of it to be lived or experienced. So, you know, the possibility, oh, we could, you know, once again think, oh, what would happen if we did that and forget to laugh? The Holy Spirit would be right there saying, well, you know, that's a funny thing. No. So, you know, we have that guarantee that we'll never wander into this kind of insanity again. That's a real gift.
It really is.
And the Course does say that. Jesus does say that in the Course, and very explicitly, just as what Persa just said. So anyway, yeah.
Can I just respond briefly to what
sure.
you were saying? One thing you said, I think, brings up a whole realm of ego defenses that, you know, are kind of the immediate knee-jerk response to the idea of quote, giving up the world, unquote, and that the world disappears. I think the unchallenged assumption and the basic premise that the ego has is that there's something in the world that's beautiful or kind or loving or you know, worth preserving, including individuality. But what A Course in Miracles tells us at every turn is that the spirit that we really are includes everything, and not just everything that, you know, we think we like, but truly everything that really has value and meaning to us. And it's because it's such a challenging concept that we think that our individuality offers us something. I don't think we really get, any of us, how the spirit that we really all are is all included, and no one is left out. You know, like, and again, you know, Gary's previous book, Love Has Forgotten No One, you know, that I think begins to describe the idea that I think A Course in Miracles is founded on, that's, you know, kind of, it's really beyond the curriculum, which is forgiveness, to remove the barriers to love, but the love that we really are and have already is so profoundly inclusive that, you know, one of the ego tactics is to try to convince us that we're going to be giving up something, that there's going to be some kind of sacrifice or compromise in the atonement, as A Course in Miracles describes it, by giving up ego, that, you know, we're still terrified of that. We think that our individuality gives us some kind of benefit. Right. But it's only because we haven't thoroughly, truly, objectively, even in, if you can think of it as a scientific way, and in the best use of that word, you know, looked at with Holy Spirit, with our inner kindness teacher, with the full faculty of the mind, basically, the crazy idea that a separate self could bring us anything of value. So I think there's other places in the course where, you know, it says, I think in chapter 5, you know, I've saved every loving thought and, you know, I've preserved the beauty and purified them of their errors and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, that's
pretty good.
The idea that, you know, we have everything we need in truth saved for us because it was never left. But we think that, you know, I guess the bottom line that I keep coming back to is that we think we're giving up something when we listen to the ego's, you know, propaganda. We think that there's something here in our dream projections that needs defending and attack, and that endless vicious cycle of fear, attack, defense, you know, retaliation, and then the Monty Python, you know, Trojan rabbit, run away when it's hurled over the castle walls. But, you know, but it's that crazy stuff that we think that there's something that we need to attack or defend, and that's separate from us. And it's just a silly movie, isn't it? I mean,
there's
nothing there.
And you know, you bring up a really, really, really good point, and something that, you just think about it. Think about the movies or things that you've seen. For instance, Star Trek, and there's this characters called the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
And the Borg are a collective, and as they come upon any form of life, they absorb that life into their collective, and that life becomes a part of the hive. And the being that is that individual becomes one of many, is no longer seen as an individual, but is, you know, it's sort of as an individual, but the mind itself is a part of the collective mind. And we're horrified by that. Or we see things like The Puppet Masters, which is a brilliant, brilliant, I think Robert Heinlein wrote that, brilliant story, maybe Isaac Asimov. Anyway, the Puppet Masters, which, you know, come to Earth and connect themselves to humans, and in that connection, they are one mind, and the humans that are connected become a part of that one mind as well. And they are blissful, and they're joyful, and they're ecstatically happy because they're a part of a whole, of a collective. But the people from the outside, when I look at my husband and see that he's been attached by this thing, no longer is he the individual that I know and love. I'm terrified of it. You know, I'm horrified of it because they're no longer the one thing that I think that they are. So that's how the ego teaches us, you know, becoming part of the whole, losing your individual knowledge of yourself, giving up your own ability to choose. That's a terrible thing. Don't give up your ability to choose.
Because the ego thinks it's really hip to do that. It's hip autonomy. But it's hip autonomous is really dangerous, though.
It is really dangerous, hip autonomous. Oh, my God. I wish you were an artist so you could draw up these pictures of these things that come on your mind. It's hilarious. Maybe you are, and I don't know that. But
Dave Van Dyke and I are working on a book together, and slowly but surely. And so we've talked about doing some graphics since he's brilliant at that stuff.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, he's awesome with that stuff. But anyway, I guess my point is we reject oneness because it means the end of me, the end of the ego, the end of the separate autonomous being. Uh-huh. But we've never been a separate autonomous being. There is no single me. I could not exist, and in fact, I would not exist. If the rest of this was all gone and it was only just Lynn, the body here, it would be dead in an instant. It couldn't survive without everything, every bit of the dream or illusion. It's an integral thing. And that's not because it was purposed that way. It just couldn't be any different. Because the one thing that we do know is that the interdependence and the oneness of what we are is the correct way to be. So even in the dream and illusion, the interdependence, we build it up with our own little specialness, special relationships, and need to be individual, all that kind of stuff. But the reality of it is we can never make it as happy as heaven or as joyful as heaven, because individuality means that you must compete. Individuality means that there must be a winner and a loser. I have to eat that cow or I will not live. It must die so I can live. The germs in the air must die so I can live, or I must die so they can live. You know, this is the give and take part of the duality that is when you look at it, it's all murder and death is all it is. But we prefer that to heaven where there's no competition because there's no I. There's no me who can be the winner. And winning is important to me, what I am. It's just choosing silliness over peace.
Yeah, and I again, once we look at the media that we consume, I've noticed certainly in the last few years an upswing in popular. You know, not that they weren't always popular, but even more so today, the superhero genre of movies that have these collaborations with mega heroes that overcome mega villains and a classic, almost going back, well, certainly going back millennia to the cliche battles of, good versus evil. As long as there's duality, as long as there's a we and a they, there's going to be a need for some kind of warfare and some kind of defense. And what we're really defending against is the truth. We're really defending against, and I'm glad you brought up the Borg, because I was actually having a conversation, I think it was with Dave Van Dyke, as a matter of fact, the other day about that. And we were talking about how, the the whole premise of a lot of those ideas is based on, you know, one illusion in the world that is at odds with another illusion in the world, rather than a truth that transcends the illusion, which is beyond all opposites. And so, you know, I think what makes the Borg fearful is it's still working within a we they paradigm, even though its collective may have no seeming conflict within its ranks of seemingly separate aspects. But it's almost like, well, the idea that the individuality within those has been destroyed and something has been lost, because there's still the premise that there's something to be gained from the separateness. And yet also at the same time, there's the things that aren't part of that entity that are the obvious and inevitable, other that needs to be defended against. So, you know, if the Borg was truly non-dual, it wouldn't have anything to do with fear, and so the whole premise of those series of episodes would go away, right?
Yeah, that is true. And of course, you know, their only desire, you know, I don't, you know, see the Borg as being malevolent characters.
Oh, okay. Well, I never watched that many of those episodes, so I don't have much direct experience.
The best one is the Star Trek, the movie, with, the Borg Queen. Oh my God, I love that movie. And, it's like the second or third of the Star Trek movies.
Okay.
And find that one and watch it. And it doesn't have a lot of coarse parallels. Well, maybe it does. And I'm just, you know, I need to go back and watch it myself. But it's like the puppet masters, you know, what was their, you know, we look at it and say, well, they're trying to conquest, you know, that we look at the Borg and say they're trying to conquer. And in reality, you know, we want to conquer them, and that's the same thing. But all they're doing is, you know, to them, their life, the best part of their life is being in the collective. And so, you know, they don't look and say, you know, what are you going to lose by this? They're looking and saying, what can we gain? And so, there still is a win-lose situation going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
I was just thinking
the same thing. As long as there's a win-lose, where there's a we and a they, it's going to be based on a fear-based, ego-based system. And it may appear to have utopian ideals, but as long as there's otherness and the belief in separation, then there can't help but be some kind of fundamental underpinning or foundation that's based on a conflicting thought system that is fundamentally insane.
Exactly. And it looks like our time is up. My God, that time went
by.
It
goes fast, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does. I just wanted to say one little short thing here. No, maybe not. we'll leave this for another week, because it might turn into a long conversation too. Anyway, thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, all.
We have been reading The Lifetimes When Art and Persa, or when Art and Persa, when Jesus and Buddha knew each other. that was true too. The History of Mighty Companions. Thank you again, Bruce Rawls, and we'll see
you
again next. And I'll put a bookmark, and we're starting again on page, where are we at here? 132 is where I'm at.
Yep.
So, all right. Very good. Talk to you next week. I love you, brother, and have a great week. I'm excited to hear the work you're doing with Dave, because
Yeah. It's just kind of slowly, we're just kind of in a warm up phase, but we've been meeting every week for a number of months now, and have some really fun ideas to put together. So, yeah.
That's very cool. I love it. All right, honey. I will talk to you next week, and I'm going to take the mic down and turn it over to Iris. And, you know, maybe someone else would like to share with Iris today. Would be nice. Since Christopher is not here. Talk to you next week, Bruce. I love you, brother, and have a great week.
You too. Bye for now.